You're listening to a special presentation of KNKX News. I'm Ed Ronco. Our project KNKX Connects has brought us stories from Port Angeles, Centralia and Chehalis, and Bellingham. Tonight, KNKX Connects to Grays Harbor County. This is the home of Aberdeen and Hoquiam. Aberdeen, of course, was the birthplace of Nirvana. It is a center of the logging industry. And with Ocean Shores, Westport, and Seabrook along the coast, this is a vacation destination for many here in the Northwest. We're going to tell stories tonight about some of the challenges here in Grays Harbor County, as well as reasons people love calling this place home. But we begin tonight with the former, one of the area's challenges. Homelessness has been in the headlines recently in Aberdeen. There's a conversation going on there right now involving what feels to many like a growing population of people who are homeless and how the city should respond. KNKX's Will James visited Aberdeen and told me what's going on.
The debate is about this property along the Chehalis River where people have camped for possibly decades, but it's gotten a lot worse in the last couple of years. The city counted more than 100 people living on the site. And in August, the city actually bought the property with the intention of eventually clearing everyone off the site. The mayor says, you know, it's not safe. There are railroad tracks nearby. It's hard for emergency vehicles to get to the riverfront. In the meantime, the city has put up no trespassing signs and is requiring permits, written permission from the city for everyone who ventures onto the site. The person most affected by this is a local Episcopal priest, the Reverend Sarah Monroe. She's with an organization called Chaplains on the Harbor, and a lot of what she does is street outreach.
I filled a backpack with sandwiches and started walking around and getting to know people.
So she goes out into the world. She makes connections with homeless people in Aberdeen. She provides help on a case-by-case basis. You know, she might drive someone to a doctor's appointment. She gets a lot of phone calls asking her to come down to the encampment on short notice to help with a crisis or an emergency that might be going on there. And she was denied a permit.
A permit to access the site.
That's right, yeah. Because she says she wasn't able to provide a schedule of when she goes to the site to do these things. And what she's done is she's actually filed a federal lawsuit over this policy by the city seeking to reverse it.
I think my impetus for doing this was the fact that I saw people being more and more isolated. And having walked with people for a long time, I know how difficult life already is on the street. And this kind of attempt to isolate people even further was something that I found very disturbing, and I felt like it was something that needed to be challenged.
She's arguing that the city's policy infringes on her rights of religious expression and also the people she's helping, their rights of religious expression.
So First Amendment.
Yeah.
Okay, so Sarah Monroe does not have a permit. What does she do now?
She still goes to the site, and she's continuing her work.
I'm never quite sure if I could get arrested for it or not.
I actually went there with her recently. I was denied a permit as well, but I kind of followed her onto the site to see how she goes about this. We walked onto this muddy plain. It goes about as far as you can see. It's this plain of tents and makeshift shelters and old RVs and cars. It looks kind of like a junkyard in places. And what the Reverend Sarah Monroe does is she stops people along the way. She strikes up conversations with them. It's clear that a lot of people there know her. They kind of walk up to her and hug her and strike up conversations themselves.
God bless you, man. Always. Working on it.
At one point, we stop at this big wooden cross along the river. This is the site where not long ago, a guy who had been kind of a leader in the encampment, a guy named Sean, died. He was in his 40s. He had a lot of chronic health problems. Reverend Sarah was called to rush down there when she heard that he was dying and actually was able to perform last rites for him.
He died here on this spot. His longtime girlfriend was with him, and his two sons and a daughter, and just a lot of the kids that he had protected. There was just dozens of people standing around him.
That's an example of the type of work that she does. It's often at a moment's notice without kind of a schedule or a plan.
Which makes it hard for her to comply with the permitting regulations.
Yeah, and she says that's the sort of work that's most affected by these regulations. It's the sort of unofficial helpers who are affected by this. It's the friends and family members who stop by the encampment to check up on relatives, to drop things off. That's what's being affected by this.
So what does the city of Aberdeen say about all of this?
Our colleague Simone Alisea spoke to the mayor, Eric Larson, and what he says is the city owns this property now and has a responsibility to regulate who goes there. The city has an interest in making sure drug dealers, other people with ill intent, aren't allowed on the site. And he says this whole debate is kind of beside the point in his view, because the issue that he's more focused on is what the city is going to do when it eventually clears the site of everyone living there.
We both can agree on it's not a great thing for them to be down there. It's not a safe situation. They need to have better opportunities for housing. There needs to be a higher level. But like, how do we get there? And that conversation tends to be where, well, I saw the city did this, or we can do that. And it's like, okay, but that's going to cost X, and it needs to be run by somebody who's going to do that. And those conversations don't tend to go very far.
Homelessness is a visible problem in cities like Seattle and Tacoma, and we have seen it across the region as well. So how does what's happening in Aberdeen compare to what we've seen throughout Western Washington?
We think of Aberdeen and Grays Harbor sometimes as vastly different economically from Seattle and King County, but it's striking that the forces that are driving homelessness there are substantially the same as they are in Seattle. It's housing has gotten more expensive, and places where people were able to live with low incomes, like cheap hotels, have closed down. One of Reverend Sarah's apprentices, a guy named James Peterson, has been homeless in Aberdeen as recently as last winter. It feels like to him, the city of Aberdeen is embarrassed. The city is trying to raise its profile, to improve its image, to attract visitors and investment. And to him, it seems like the city views this problem as a stain, as an obstacle to be cleaned up.
You know, the people that we're supposed to count on to help run the city assume that our homelessness is like a disappointment or an issue against the city of Aberdeen. They don't treat us like we are the people of Aberdeen, and they just want to erase it.
You know, in city after city, we've seen this divide between people who view homelessness as primarily a quality of life issue, an urban blight issue that needs to be fixed because of its holistic effects on the entire community, and people who view this as a human crisis that needs kind of a more human intervention. And that has been a source of conflict in every corner of our region, and it's true in Aberdeen as well.
Will James, thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
KNKX's Will James, reporting in Aberdeen. You heard a little from the mayor of Aberdeen there, Eric Larson. He was hailed as the millennial mayor when he was elected in 2015. He was just 23 years old. We wanted to talk to Larson a little more about being the mayor of the town where he grew up, so he sat down with KNKX reporter Simone Alisea at a coffee shop near City Hall.
I was born in 1991 here in Aberdeen, and you know, I kind of grew up through kind of that aimless period of, you know, we've lost our identity, we're no longer a timber area, what are we going to do? But as a community, we're really reinventing ourselves and growing into the future and being part of the global economy, and I think that's where we're going to continue to move.
You have several generations going back to Aberdeen. Aberdeen isn't just your hometown, but I think it was your great-great-grandfather, do I have that right?
It was my great-great-grandfather moved to this area, and my family's lived in this area since then. My dad and grandfather own a restaurant in town, Duffy's, and that's been in the family and open in the area since the 30s, and so, or no, 40s. I'm gonna get in trouble for that, but but they've been around for almost 70 years now, and so that's kind of been a mainstay in an ever-changing community.
So born in 1991, you got a degree in civil engineering from Washington State University, and then you came back and ran for mayor. Why?
I think really I came back to work for the Vaughn Company as an engineer, and you know, I started looking at you know, buying my first home and getting, you know, committed to the area and saying I'm going to be here a while. And you know, with that came the realization and knowledge of I know the community is still trying to reinvent itself. I'm very invested in where the community goes from here. How can I be involved in helping shape that? And that was really where that came from. It kind of snowballed. You know, it really was, I think in the beginning it was kind of a novelty, you know, oh, 20-something-year-old guy is running for mayor, you know, this is interesting, you know, let's, you know, it wasn't taken very seriously, but there was a novelty to it. And then as, you know, we did debates and public engagements and, you know, canvassing and talking to people and kind of sharing my view, I feel like my credibility continued to grow. But the most interesting thing is if you dig down to the demographics of the election, most of my support came from the 65-plus crowd.
Which
I never would have thought would happen. I talked to a couple people that were very much older in the community. I mean, you know, late 70s, early 80s. And a lot of them said, well, you know, a lot of us are retired. We're here the rest of our lives. We had our time. You know, we saw the good times of Syria and we've seen the bad. And we really don't think you could do much worse. And let's see what you can do.
I actually realize I don't know. Did you declare a party when you ran?
I did. I'm a Democrat, and I'm a member of the local Democratic Party. And you know, I feel very strongly about a lot of the social issues that we're facing. But I'm a fairly moderate. I think I would be considered a moderate Democrat. I think generally local politics are not party politics, and I have my personal opinions and views, and I have my elected position, you know, opinions and views of what I believe is best for the city, and those aren't necessarily always the same. There might be something where I feel very strongly about it, but I know it would have a negative impact on the city, and you know, you have that kind of internal struggle of, you know, do I stick by my morals or do I do what I think is best for the city? And those can be tough ones.
Well, and I think you're right to say that local politics and sort of the national, they're not necessarily the same thing for anyone, for a voter or for an elected official. But also, I'll point out that Aberdeen, Grays Harbor County, it's a very purple area.
I mean, for example, you know, how Congress and the presidency are working together, regardless of whether it's a Democratic Congress or a Republican Congress or the split Congress that we have that just got elected, if there's deadlock at the federal level, it impacts whether funding bills get passed and whether budgets get passed and whether an infrastructure package gets passed. And that is the funding that we depend on. And so, you know, when they're in gridlock, it really has a trickle-down effect. And so, you know, that's an example of what I might want to see politically might not necessarily match what the city of Aberdeen is hoping for in terms of. So those are the sorts of things that can come into play, especially as we have some major infrastructure projects that are potentially qualifying for federal funding, but there's not really any federal funding to be had.
Eric Larson, mayor of Aberdeen, thank you so much for taking the time and talking to me today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
He spoke with KNKX reporter Simone Alisea there. Now, Mayor Larson does say that he plans to run for re-election next year. And last week, he celebrated his 27th birthday. Larson was born the same year Nirvana released its album Nevermind. The Aberdeen band launched the grunge music scene in Seattle and eventually the nation. And we'll be real honest, we did not do our own Kurt Cobain story in this program because everyone who comes here does that story. But there's a store in town dedicated to Star Wars, actually, and it has a whole section for the late Nirvana frontman. So we talked to the owner, Don Suker, about why.
What got me here was Vietnam. I'm from Idaho. I'm a young bumpkin running around a farm, and they sent me to Fort Lewis to get ready to go to Vietnam. Well, now I leave Idaho. It's below zero. The roads have been froze for 2 months. I land in McCord, and it's 50 degrees, and everything's green. I says, man, if I make it back, man, I'm moving to Washington. And so I made it back. Thank you, Jimi Hendrix. I seen him 3 days before I shipped out, and I thought, you know, I'm going to make it back. I took his album, and I took a record player with me, and I would play Purple Haze on guard duty. Anyway, I guess the city fathers back in the day didn't want anybody to highlight Kurt, you know. So nobody in town was doing anything, period. And I kept having a lot of people stop and want to know something. So I created a little map that I would, when they came in, I would hand out to them and point out where several places he hung out and where his star is and where he bought his guitar and where he got in jail and, you know, that kind of thing. You'd be surprised how many Kurt fans love Star Wars. So they feel like they got two for one here.
That's Don Suker of Suker & Son Star Wars Shop in Aberdeen talking about how the store also came to have a Kurt Cobain section. In June, the worst thing that can happen to a museum happened here. A fire destroyed Aberdeen's historic armory building, which housed the Aberdeen Museum of History. Black smoke billowed from the building as firefighters tried to attack the flames. The museum lost a lot of artifacts, and what was not destroyed by the fire was almost certainly damaged by smoke or by the water used to extinguish the flames. In addition to the firefighters and police who responded that day, a group of archivists also rushed to the scene from the State Archives in Olympia.
So I'm Mary Hammer, and I'm the Digital Projects and Preservation Archivist at the Washington State Archives. Originally, we went out to the site of the Aberdeen fire, and there were people that could go into the building and rescue items. We weren't allowed to go in, but they would bring the items out to us, and we loaded them into a van and brought them back to the archives.
Things moved pretty fast the day of the fire. Triage decisions were made right there on the street about which items could be saved and how quickly they needed attention.
I mean, when you first see it covered in soot, you think, there is no way that this is going to come out okay. And then you just rinse it off a little bit, and almost magically the images appear, the soot's gone, and you have your item as beautiful as it was before. And as some people have mentioned, some things are better off than they were before because they got a little rinsing and a little cleaning.
Now, photographs from the museum, documents, VHS tapes, cassettes, more than 130 boxes of materials, all told, are stored in a cooled underground space in Olympia. If the day of the fire was like being in a historical artifact emergency room, this place is sort of like a recovery room. It's a quiet, controlled area for these artifacts to be safe while the Aberdeen Museum regroups. Meanwhile, there are plenty of other artifacts that are recovering from their injuries much closer to home. Inside a warehouse along the Chehalis River, crews from Restoration Management Company have been working for, 2 months or so, scrubbing, brushing, degreasing, and drying item after item. Lulu Bonaparte is wiping soot off a huge wooden picture frame.
My job, I love it. Every job, they're so different. Every day, they learn something new.
She's been doing this type of work for 32 years, and usually she's dealing with a household item after a basement flood or a house fire. So cleaning up museum artifacts is a little bit different. But one thing that does not seem to change from job to job is dealing with people who have almost always been through something traumatic or stressful. Bonaparte says she likes that about her work and turns to the ease of Spanish to fully explain why.
Gente primero porque es lo más importante para uno. Lo demás es menos importante. So primero es importante las personas y luego lo demás.
Cleaning up the artifacts is important, she says, but caring for the people always comes first.
It's hard.
That's one of the people, Dan Sears. He was director of the Aberdeen Museum of History for 17 years before stepping down to serve as an archivist. He cares about this collection deeply.
Sometimes I just got to come out and stare off into the bluff and just kind of clear your head, you know?
Sears grew up here. He was in the class of 62, and he spent more than 30 years in North Carolina before coming home in 2000. His whole career has been spent in museums, and that's not necessarily what people who grew up with him would have predicted.
And I hated history when I was going to school because it's so darn boring.
He does not feel that way anymore. He says museums and collections, like the one that people are trying so hard to clean up here in Aberdeen, are as important to the future as they are to the past.
If we could go into a history class and bring a box of artifacts in, you know, and talk about that portion of the history and show them and let them feel what history's about, then they're going to get more involved in it.
There's still a ways to go before the Aberdeen Museum of History completely recovers from the fire. The city council voted recently to tear down the armory building. Its facade is still standing, but most of the roof is gone, and you can see the devastation of missing floors and blackened wood inside. The State Archives is holding on to those 130 or so boxes of artifacts until the Aberdeen Museum can take them back. The bigger stuff, the pianos, the engines, the statues, those are being sent to a storage facility. But eventually, the plan is to bring them home to a new museum in Aberdeen, even if no one's sure yet exactly where that will be. You're listening to a KNKX News special report. We're bringing you stories from Grays Harbor County tonight as part of our KNKX Connects project. I'm Ed Ronco. Thanks for joining us. A lot of the menus around Grays Harbor County offer some form of shellfish. An oyster shack tops the list of offerings in the county's Farm Fresh Guide. Together with Willapa Bay to the south, this region represents the single largest oyster growing area in the United States. It's said to produce a quarter of all oysters in this country, and that has grown hundreds of rural jobs since the industry started here about a century ago. But it's facing a big challenge right now. KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe visited an oyster grower and told me a little about what she found.
I went to meet with Kathleen Nisbet-Monsey of Nisbet Oyster Company, which has the Goose Point brand. They're right on Willapa Bay at the mouth of the Niwakum River. And one thing that really hit me during this visit is that this is actually a big agricultural crop. Perhaps I should say aquacultural, but the point is 98% of the oysters grown in Washington are actually non-native, fast-growing Pacific oysters that were first imported from Japan about a century ago. Here's how Kathleen Monsey describes it.
It's actually farming, like traditional farming. So we plant our oyster seed, we cultivate our oyster seed, and then at 3 years, we actually go out and harvest it.
And this is a big moneymaker in a mostly rural area. As an example, she told me about how her dad, David Nisbet, started this company about 40 years ago with just 10 acres, a small boat, and a couple of his cousins. She says they now have about 100 employees. They hold about 2,000 acres of tidelands and work about 600 of those per year. They pack those oysters up and ship them all over the U.S. and also overseas into Hong Kong and China.
But they are facing a big problem right now. We're talking about infestations of burrowing shrimp.
Right. It sounds awful, doesn't it? This is a problem for the non-native oysters, which grow best on the bottom of the tidelands. And there are two species of native shrimp. They look kind of like little crawfish. And when they increase in number, they turn the mudflats into what is described as like quicksand. And this suffocates the oysters when they sink beneath it. Now, from the mid-1960s till 2013, growers used a neurotoxin called carbaryl to manage the shrimp populations. But they agreed to phase it out over a 10-year period and look for another solution. And without carbaryl, the shrimp have been coming back. Here's Kathleen Monsey again.
The burrowing shrimp infestation has increased significantly over the last 3 years to the point where we're losing large amounts of tidelands to the shrimp. We're worried that with the continued destruction that's happening out into the estuary, we won't only lose more and more tidelands, but we're also going to lose more and more habitat in the ecosystem in general. The ecosystem as a whole is out of balance because of the amount of burrowing shrimp that's there. We're the ones that have seen it, and we're the ones that have been managing it. But at this point in time, it's becoming a bigger issue than oyster farmers can continue to bear the burden of, and we really need help to be able to bring this ecosystem back into a balance again.
Her company is one of about a dozen oyster farms that want to use a newer pesticide. It's called imidacloprid to control the shrimp.
And so when I hear the word pesticide, I think of land more than I think of water. What is imidacloprid?
It's a neonicotinoid, widely used in agriculture on land, as you say, but also known for causing bee colony collapse and increasingly controversial. It was banned recently in the EU, and it's never before been approved for use in the water. So the State Department of Ecology gave it a green light initially for use in 2015. But after a big public outcry, the oyster growers withdrew their application, and a smaller group came back with a request to use it on fewer acres as a test. Ecology denied that application this year, and Monsey is part of the group that is appealing that decision. She says after over a decade and millions of dollars of research, this is the only current solution they have, and she is convinced that using it would be safe.
There is no way I would ever do anything that would harm the ecosystem that feels my family, that feels my community, that feels all of my employees. I would do nothing that would put that at a detriment, and that is not what we're doing.
And she told me point blank, she thinks if left untreated, the ghost shrimp will put them out of business in the next 5 to 7 years.
So they are fighting this. There's a legal fight here.
That's right. They are appealing. And just this week, the Pollution Control Board set the hearing for September. They've scheduled up to 2 full weeks of testimony on this from oyster growers who want this pesticide and then Ecology defending its decision.
And 2 whole weeks would suggest how complicated this issue is and how many viewpoints there are on it, because there are oyster growers who don't want the pesticide, right?
Definitely. A really interesting one that's been against the pesticides all along is called the Ad Hoc Coalition for Willapa Bay. And one of its founders, Larry Warnberg, he grew pesticide-free oysters in Willapa Bay for 25 years. And he says, if you kill all of the shrimp, that's the problem. That's what leads to the population explosions and infestations that kill off the oysters.
If you don't spray, as I didn't for 25 years, you get a stable population of a few adult shrimp, and they're carnivorous. They eat those juveniles that come in because they don't want to share their territory.
Warnberg's not a scientist. He's someone who's said he's experienced this firsthand, but he says essentially the ecosystem will recover over time if we stay away from the pesticides. And he's worried about other invertebrates that these pesticides kill at the same time, everything from Dungeness crabs to clams and eelworms. And Warnberg says he's concerned about the broader long-term effects of targeting these shrimp themselves.
They're considered a foundation species or a keystone species, much like trees in a forest. They create habitat for other wildlife.
So we've got ecological concerns, we've got business concerns, and a fear of going out of business in a very short amount of time. It sounds like there's a lot at stake here.
You know, this is a huge part of Washington's shellfish industry, which is generating so many good rural jobs. All of this hanging in the balance as the state hears the appeal next fall and decides whether to allow this first-time use of imidacloprid in the water. A lot of people will be following this, myself included.
All right. Bellamy Palethorpe, our environment reporter at KNKX, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed.
And you can find more of Bellamy's coverage of this issue and some photos by Parker Blome at knkx.org. Let's stay on the shore for a few more minutes. At the west end of Hoquiam, where the Chehalis River begins to open into a bay, you'll find the Grays Harbor National Wildlife Refuge. It shares a little peninsula with Bowerman Airport. The refuge is safe harbor for shorebirds attracted to crustaceans and worms that live in its mudflats. Producer Jeffrey Reddick went for a walk in the refuge with Arnie Martin, the president of the Grays Harbor Audubon Society.
I have to say that you're not going to hear many birds in the next few minutes. Wrong time of year.
I hear some wrens and stuff, but I see no shorebirds.
You also won't hear me losing a boot in the mudflats, something that's happened to Arnie Martin before. We stuck to the boardwalk at the refuge. That's where hordes of people gather in the spring to welcome migrating shorebirds as they make their way to breeding grounds in the Arctic. Martin says there can be 20,000 to 30,000 birds a day here during that time. Plovers, turnstones, sandpipers, even Caspian terns.
Caspian terns nest on Sand Island on the Columbia River, and they come up here to feed. They go quonk, quonk.
Arnie Martin's been interested in birds since he was a kid. He was on a road trip with his grandparents when they had an encounter.
We had a snowy owl fly right across in front of the car when I was driving, and I said, wow, it's a snowy owl. And I sort of just perked up and said, well, I should go on an Audubon field trip. And I saw a bird on that first field trip that I've only seen once since. It should have been in Siberia, but it got lost. I said, well, that's fun. So I went on a few more field trips, got involved in the Audubon Society, and met my future wife there.
13 years ago, Martin moved to Grays Harbor County. He had retired, and he was looking for a nice place to relax and watch birds. Turns out he's been more hands-on than he planned to be. There have been proposals at the Port of Grays Harbor that would have affected the wildlife refuge. Coal and oil terminals. They would have meant jobs, but also threats to the natural world.
When we started fighting against coal terminals and oil terminals, we were probably like a voice crying in the wilderness, but then we kept putting on these programs where we pointed out to them that this is what can happen to your area. You want to have salmon, you want to have fishing jobs, and if you have a crude oil spill in here, we pointed out to them what the potential downfalls were, and we went from having probably 20% supporting us to something like 65% supporting us.
What does this place mean to you?
A lot of people come out here for just the quiet and the refuge. There's a lot of people who think this is almost a spiritual place. I'm not very spiritual, but I enjoy it an awful lot, and I do think it's a great place to spend some time, kind of let you unwind a bit. Oh, there's some shorebirds going by right now.
A flock of small white birds take to the air. They move as one, and they're a little hard to see against the clouds.
And this is probably a Coast Guard helicopter coming in. the overflights from the military have increased since I've been here. They've put in a flight pattern coming out of Whidbey Island. Yeah, that's a Coast Guard helicopter. Hello.
Lots of birds.
These are all shorebirds. And
it's hypnotic how they fly together.
It is. It's and that's how they, if they're trying to evade predators, it's just like a boiling thing. It's just amazing. If you're from the Midwest, you may have seen starling flights where they try to evade having, like probably peregrine falcons flying through, and shorebirds do the same thing. And it's just, whoa, we do have a falcon out there. This is a falcon flying.
It was maybe after that flock.
Indeed it was.
Well, I'm glad we got to see some.
Yeah, we did. And to see a falcon fly by was pretty impressive this time of year. And a flock of maybe 500 shorebirds this time of year is pretty nice, too.
That's Arnie Martin, president of the Grays Harbor Audubon Society and the chairman of the annual Shorebird Festival. The next one takes place during the first weekend in May. Last week, we broadcast All Things Considered from the Aberdeen Timberland Library in front of a live audience. And the library is a community gathering place. It offers books, of course, but also computer access, magazines, newspapers, audiobooks. There's even some artwork you can check out for a little while. Stephanie Reese is a senior library manager in the Timberland system. She joined us live during the broadcast and told us how the library in Aberdeen doesn't just open its doors to the public every day, but also goes out into the community. One way is through a partnership with Grays Harbor College to help people take classes to complete credits toward a high school diploma.
Yeah, this is just an example of some of the things that libraries are doing nowadays. It's about creating partnerships with people and organizations that we never have before. We're seeing needs and taking on some of that in the community. And this particular program we just launched is called High School 21 Plus. And this is a partnership through the Washington State Library and the Community and Technical Colleges State Board. Our college is Grays Harbor College. We've created a process where people who have not yet completed their high school diploma can come into the library and start the paperwork and start that process.
So the library can facilitate that.
Yeah, it's a little less intimidating than, you know, maybe going onto a college campus, or maybe you're too far away and you think this is never going to happen because I live in rural Grays Harbor County, you know, Amanda Park, or...
But there's a branch in Amanda Park.
There's a branch in West Park. Exactly. So what we've done is we've taken that hardship out. And then basically what's really cool about this is that you get credit for life and job experiences that you've already had. So it's a great validation of the learning that you've done in your regular life.
Well, so you're also, you know, you're also walking around Aberdeen with a clipboard.
Yes.
Not to oversimplify what you're doing here, but no. You're asking people questions, and it's not the usual, like, what do you want from your library? What books should we have? What movies should we have? What are you asking people?
Yeah. So what we're asking is, you know, what kind of community do you want to live in? Why is that important? How is that different from what you see now?
Why are you asking those questions?
Why are we asking those? We're focused on listening to the values and needs of our communities. Mm-hmm. By focusing on what people want to see, we don't choose it for them. They choose it. Huh. They choose their library. They choose their services. And we're just listening to what that is.
So you're letting them build the program.
Yes.
Basically.
Yes. We're planning for our future of our libraries. And we want to talk to everyone that we can to say, hey, what does that look like to you?
Can you give an example of something someone's told you that you know, stands out?
We're getting a lot of answers about we want the library to be a community space, a social space, a general environment of safety and helpfulness, communication and core values of a community being clean and respectful, kind and generous. Kind of why that's important to people is that they want to make a home and raise a family here.
You moved here.
Mm-hmm.
This is not your hometown,
no.
But this is the community you serve. So what was it that brought you here that said, that's the library I need to work at?
We, after college, we were looking for our big adventure, my husband and I. Honestly, we knew Pacific Northwest was some place that was very pretty and beautiful and had all kinds of access to different things, which Kansas does have a little bit of. But we were looking for, like, my job's very specific, libraries. You have to, you know, kind of get real specific, and there's usually only one in the town. So Aberdeen called. We came out 5 years ago. We came for the mountains and the ocean and the air, and I think what we stayed for is the people in the community. There's something about this place that you just want to reach out and you want to help. And I've never shied away from a challenge, and so even though there might be some challenges to this place, I wanted to make it better.
Stephanie, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Stephanie Reese is a senior library manager for Timberland Regional Library. She's at the Aberdeen branch. This is a KNKX News special. I'm Ed Ronco. Tonight, KNKX connects to Grays Harbor County. Let's listen back to part of our special broadcast of All Things Considered in front of a live audience at the Aberdeen Timberland Library. One of our guests that day was John Larson, director of the Polson Museum in Hoquiam. The museum is dedicated to local history, and it has a big focus on logging. In fact, John showed up to his interview with some sawdust on his sweatshirt, and he brought us two cuts of wood. I've got them right here. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But first, we asked him for a little glimpse into the area's logging history, starting with the industry's heyday.
If you look at statistics, it would be about 1926.
Okay.
And the big statistic that year was what got shipped out of here by the water. Port of Grace Harbor had 1.75 billion board feet of lumber shipped across the bar of Grace Harbor.
Paint a picture for us. If we were walking around Aberdeen and Hoquiam and this area, what would this place have looked like?
It would have been bustling with people, pedestrians, streetcars. You would have had sawmills on just about every open spot on the waterfront operating, just a tremendous amount of activity.
Logging gets talked about in the historical context a lot, but it is still very much part of the now here.
Well, you walk around Grace Harbor, you see a log truck about every 4 or 5 minutes pass you. You see a chip truck, you see a veneer truck, you see plywood, you see all the things that come from the forest around us are very much part of our economy today.
You are a little sawdusty because the museum has a sawmill.
Yeah, we have this portable Lucas Mill, it's called. Uh-huh. We share it with the historical seaport. We bought it new about 10 years ago.
What does the museum do with a sawmill?
We make our own lumber, which we use in our own restoration projects or any other exhibit work that we do.
So you are director of the museum, a historian, and a sawyer.
Chief sawyer.
Yeah. Chief sawyer.
We actually, what you have in your hand there is a little bit of spruce and a little bit of hemlock.
Okay.
Fresh milled today.
Still damp.
Still damp, yep. Very damp, yeah, very wet. We stickered it, ready to dry, and that actually belongs to the Moclips Museum, the North Beach Museum. They're looking to build a new facility modeled after the 1905 Northern Pacific Depot at Moclips, and they logged some timber this summer. We said we'd mill it for them, and today and yesterday we got started on that, and we're having fun with it. So
you grew up here. You came back after college. What was it about the opportunity that brought you back here?
I'm a museum guy at heart, so I wanted to work in the industry, or if you call it that, of museums, and that's what I landed. Got lucky to land in my own hometown. I've been 22 years doing that job, and it's not so much a job as it is just a love.
John Larson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Larson is director of the Polson Museum in Hoquiam, and he spoke to us in front of a live audience last week at the Aberdeen Timberland Library. Now, you heard him say that he came back to town after college, but not everyone does. Like any place, some of the people who grew up here go on to build their adult lives elsewhere. That was the case for my friend Stephanie Ask. She grew up in Hoquiam and now lives on Whidbey Island, where she's a teacher. And maybe the way Stephanie talks about her hometown reminds me a little bit of where I grew up, in a suburb of Detroit where so many jobs were tied to one industry, autos in our case, and where the economy took some serious hits over the years. Metro Detroit, like Hoquiam, is a place that people from outside seem to have plenty of opinions about, even if they've never been there. So I asked Stephanie to help me address that idea, what it's like to know a place intimately, to leave and to still love it, even when others might not. We went for a walk down Queets Avenue through the neighborhood where Stephanie grew up and where her mother still lives.
Like many places, I would say, in the harbor, we're walking down a pretty standard street that I think is iconic for a few reasons. You'll notice that the sidewalks are up and down and broken and all over the place. While all these houses are pretty tight together, you see a house that is got this incredibly taken care of lawn and brush and really, really like finely taken care of. And then you'll see a house that has some boarded up windows. And then you'll see a house that is probably pretty loved and there's a lot of adventures in it.
There's a hillside across the street from us about 6 stories high. Just about 3 years ago, this was after Stephanie moved away, heavy and sudden rains did a lot of damage to that hillside and the neighborhood.
My mom's place flooded, and luckily our house is up just a little bit, but our garage completely flooded. My mom wanted to call and like talk about like, I just, I'm so sad about these things that you've lost. And I just said, do not, just don't tell me. It's been long enough. I probably don't remember. And if you tell me what things are, of mine are gone, I'll be sad. And if you don't, I just maybe won't ever remember.
So did she not tell you? Do you still not know?
I still don't know.
Stephanie might not have all the stuff that she used to growing up here, but she does have some vivid memories. We stroll down the stretch of sidewalk where she learned to ride a bike.
Rather than put training wheels on my bicycle, Dad would take a broom handle and he would shove it under the back of the seat and he would run behind me down the alley, back and forth. He was 53 when I was born. So you got to imagine this old man running back and forth down this alley to try and hold up child on a bicycle, right?
Late 50s, maybe pushing 60.
Yeah, and I actually remember like wanting to keep going and him being like, Dad's got to take a break.
So I ask her how memories like that come into play when she encounters people who did not come from here and who think they know a thing or two about this place.
I think when you're growing up, you have a tendency to crack jokes and make fun of where you're from. It's the same way you make jokes about your family. You know, it's the thing that you know so well, so you can kind of see through the cracks. I remember being with Cassidy when we were first dating and going to visit his family.
Cassidy's your husband.
Yes. And we were in the ferry line, and he ran into a friend's dad, and the friend's dad asked, like, oh, where are you guys coming back to town from? And Cassidy said, oh, we were in Hoquiam. And he went into, like, a five-minute rant about how crappy this place was and all these, like, and it felt like that sort of feeling where you're like, you can't talk about my family. I can make jokes about my family, but this is not your place. And so you feel this like swelling of like rage and sort of pride for this place. And that's what I will say, is that a lot of people can sort of make jokes here and there, and we can talk about, I think, really lovely conversations that are critical about some of the challenges and problems that exist in this area and the things we want to do to fix it. A lot of that can be said. And yes, like, jokes can be made. But I do think for a place that you can call a sort of depressed area, at least economically, there is an amazing amount of heart here.
One example of that heart is the annual football competition. It plays off the longstanding football rivalry between Hoquiam and Aberdeen. Students from both high schools raise money and food for local food banks. This year together, they raised more than $155,000 and some 13,000 pounds of food. Stephanie participated in the football competition when she was a student at Hoquiam High School, and it stuck with her. She teaches high school now in Coopville and says that she tries to share that feeling of community with her students.
So I'm always trying to make a community out of my little classroom and make a community out of my little group. Or I teach theater, and I'm always telling the kids, like, no, we're a family. We take care of each other. This is what we do. I imagine that's probably normal for any teacher, but I think it probably is fueled by a certain sense of that. Like, you may have people here who think differently than you or believe things differently than you do or that even offend you sometimes. But at the end of the day, we're all in this together. We're going to do something. We're going to take care of each other.
Is there something that people who aren't from places like this don't understand?
This area in particular exists with a lot of people driving through the center. You are just, most people, if they're not stopping here, they are driving through to get to the beach or get to the peninsula or get on I-5. And they're not necessarily stopping. And so you get this image that this place is only what is on the main drag. And I don't think that gives a full picture. Certainly, that's part of who we are, but there's all sorts of sort of fascinating and interesting little pockets all over the place that have a lot to offer that maybe you'd find if you explored a little bit.
It's my friend Stephanie Ask, who teaches on Whidbey Island, but grew up in Hoquiam, and she was nice enough to show me around her neighborhood. We mentioned football a little earlier, and that's how we want to end tonight's broadcast. Hoquiam and Aberdeen High Schools have been rivals on the football field since 1906. Hoquiam won this year's game in September, 28-7. And we should note that Hoquiam had an undefeated regular season, but food ball is another rivalry that plays out here every fall. Students at the two schools compete to see who can raise the most cash and food for local food banks. Aberdeen claimed victory this year, raising more than $85,000 and 8,400 pounds of food, and they did that in about 12 days. Students and teachers we spoke to at both schools told us that, yeah, it is a competition, but it's also an exercise in teamwork.
My name is Ashley Kohlmeyer.
I'm Tamara Corona.
My name is Clark Davis.
My name is Elise Goulet, and I'm a senior at Hoquiam High School.
And I'm the ASB advisor at Aberdeen High School.
I am the ASB advisor at Hoquiam High School.
And I'm the AHS senior body president at Aberdeen High School.
So 1 in 5 students in our community don't know where their next meal is coming from. So in my classroom of 30-ish kids, I know that food ball is helping 6 of those kids.
A lot of students at our school are actually students that, like, they need the money or they need the food and they use our local resources. So I think they really appreciate it. And then the students that don't necessarily need the help, I think it helps them connect to the people more and realize how much that they're actually helping everyone. All the money we raise at Hoquiam High School goes directly to the Hoquiam Food Bank, and then all the money that Aberdeen raises, I think they disperse it amongst 6 food banks.
Our towns get a bad rep because we have so much poverty here, and I feel like just to know that we can support our local people who need all of our help, like, it's a really big deal.
This is not a very high, wealthy area at all, and you see people who you know don't have very much money, but they shuffle out of the Swanson's or Walmart or whatever, and they see a can there, and they're, you know, they know what it's for, so they'll throw their change in or give a couple dollars when they themselves could use that money. Where else can you find that?
Aberdeen and Hoquiam come together at our local PUD right on Myrtle Street, which, if you don't know, Myrtle Street is the street that divides Aberdeen and Hoquiam, and we tally up all the numbers and find out who wins food ball, and our mascots exit the building, and everybody has their poker faces on, and the mascot from the winning school gets their hand raised. That's how we did it this year, and so it was kind of like a wrestling victor, and of course the Bobcat's hand was raised, and that's how everybody found out, the community.
Me and the other food ball chairs, we went out to dinner, and we kind of were all just like, oh my god, it's done, and we, like, it's kind of sad because it took so much of my time, so it's like, it's kind of sad we're not gonna meet every night.
This 1 week of our lives affects those people and helps them for a whole year.
I do feel really fortunate to be a part of this community and a place that is just so giving.
I really enjoy it. I had a ton of fun doing it. So.
Next year, as a graduate from Aberdeen High School, I do expect to be donating. I will be an alumni that will forever donate to Aberdeen Food Ball.
Voices from Aberdeen and Hoquiam High Schools. Together, the two schools raised more than $155,000 and 13,000 pounds of food to benefit local food banks in 12 days. That'll wrap up our special broadcast tonight. Thank you so much for joining us. This program was produced and edited by Jeffrey Reddick. Our news director is Aaron Hennessy. Our director of content, Matt Martinez. We had contributions this evening from Simone Alisea, Bellamy Palethorpe, and Will James. Kari Plogue is our digital content manager, and we have photos by Parker Blome. All of it on our website, knkx.org. KNKX Connects is a project that has taken us all over the region, telling stories about communities, the issues they face, and the reasons people call those places home. Early next year, we'll be telling some of those stories from the Skagit Valley. For now, though, thanks for joining us. I'm Ed Ronco, and this is 88.5 KNKX.